At the time, we had plenty of reasons to doubt his prediction. But we all acted as though we believed him, and that his faith in us was justified. "Our future's so bright, we gotta wear shades," H declared as she slipped on a pair of Ray-Bans and boarded her jet, bound for her ancestral homeland. When Samantha and I kissed each other goodbye on the runway that morning, I never would have imagined it would be our last kiss. But I discovered the Oasis neural interface headset the very next day, and everything changed. I knew Samantha might be upset with me for testing the ONI before discussing it with her first. But since it had worked flawlessly and I wasn't harmed in any way, I assumed she would forgive my risky behavior. Instead, she got so pissed off she hung up on me before I even had a chance to finish describing all of the different things I'd experienced with the ONI and the ones I'd chosen not to experience. H and Shoto reacted to my news far more enthusiastically. They both dropped everything and flew to Columbus to try the ONI out for themselves. And when they did, they were just as blown away by the experience as I had been. It was transcendental technology. The Oasis neural interface was the ultimate prosthesis, one that could temporarily cure any ailment or injury of the human body by disconnecting the mind and reconnecting it to a new, perfectly healthy, fully functional body inside the Oasis, a simulated body that would never feel any pain, through which you could experience every pleasure imaginable. The three of us talked ourselves into a frenzy, listing all the ways this device was going to change everything. But when Samantha finally arrived on the scene, things began to go drastically downhill. I still remember every word of our exchange that day because I'd brazenly recorded it with an ONI headset while it was happening. In the 3 years since, I'd relived our conversation on an almost weekly basis. To me, it felt like our breakup had just happened a few days ago. Because for me, it had. "Take that stupid thing off," Samantha says, glancing up at the ONI headset I'm wearing. The original headset I found in Halliday's vault lies on the conference table between us, along with three duplicates, fresh from the 3D printer. "No," I say angrily. "I want to record how ridiculous you're being right now, so you can play it back later and see for yourself." H and Shoto are sitting between us on either side of the conference table, swiveling their heads back and forth like they're watching a tennis match. Shoto is hearing our conversation with a slight delay through the Mandrax translator earpiece he's wearing. "I told you," Samantha says, snatching one of the headsets off the table. "I am never going to let one of these things take control of my brain. Not ever." She hurls the headset against the wall, but it doesn't break. They're very durable. "How can you form an educated opinion when you haven't even tried it?" H asks quietly. "I've never tried sniffing paint thinner either," Samantha snaps back. She sighs in frustration and runs her hands through her hair. "I don't know why I can't make you guys understand. This is the last thing humanity needs. Can't you see that? The world is a complete mess right now." She pulls up half a dozen different world news feeds on the conference room view screen, filling it with images of poverty, famine, disease, war, and a wide array of natural disasters. Even with the audio muted, the barrage of images was pretty horrific. "Half the world already spends every waking moment ignoring reality inside the Oasis. We already peddle the opiate of the masses, and now you want to up the dosage?" I roll my eyes and shake my head. I can feel my adrenaline rising. "That's total bullshit, Artie, and you know it," I say. "We could turn off the Oasis tomorrow, and it wouldn't solve any of humanity's problems. It would just rob people of the only escape they have. I mean, I get where you're coming from, and I agree that everyone should balance their time in the Oasis with equal time in reality. But it's not our place to mandate how our users live their lives. Growing up in the stacks would have been hell for me if I hadn't had access to the Oasis. It literally saved my life, and I've heard H say the same thing." We both glance over at H. She nods in agreement. "We weren't all lucky enough to grow up in some ritzy Vancouver suburb like you, Samantha," I say. "Who are you to judge how other people deal with reality?" Samantha clenches her jaw and narrows her eyes at me, but she still doesn't reply. And I apparently take this as my cue to shove my foot even further into my mouth. All the way, in fact. Owning technology is also going to save hundreds of millions of lives, I say self-righteously, by preventing the spread of all sorts of infectious diseases, like the flu pandemic that killed both of your parents. Now it's my turn to level a finger at her. How can you be against an invention that could have prevented their deaths? She snaps her head around and looks at me in wounded surprise, like I've just slapped her across the face. Then her gaze hardens, and that's it. The exact instant her love for me disappears. I'm too amped up on adrenaline to notice it there in the moment, but I spot it plain as day on every single one of my repeat viewings. The sudden change in her eyes says it all. One second she loves me, and the next she loves me not. She never responds to my question. She just stares daggers at me in silence until Shoto finally chimes in. "We're going to make trillions of dollars selling these headsets, Artie," he says calmly. "We can use that money to help the world, to try and fix all of the things that need fixing." Samantha shakes her head. "No amount of money will be able to undo the damage these headsets are going to cause," she replies, sounding defeated now. "You guys read Og's email. He thinks releasing the ONI is a bad idea, too." "Og hasn't even tried the ONI," I say, letting too much anger creep into my voice. "He's like you, condemning it without even trying to understand its potential." "Of course I understand its potential, you idiot!" Samantha shouts. She looks around the table. "Christ! Haven't any of you rewatched The Matrix lately? Or Sword Art Online? Plugging your brain and your nervous system directly into a computer simulation is never a good idea. We're talking about giving complete control of our minds to a machine, turning ourselves into cyborgs." "Come on," H says. "You're overreacting." "No," she shouts back. "I'm not." Then she takes a deep breath before glancing around the table at all three of us. "Don't you see? This is why Halliday never released the ONI technology himself. He knew it would only hasten the collapse of human civilization by encouraging people to spend even more time escaping from reality. He didn't want to be the one responsible for opening Pandora's box." She looks at me, and now her eyes are filling with tears. "I thought you wanted to live here, in the real world, with me. But you haven't learned a goddamn thing, have you?" She reaches over and brings her fist down on the power button of the data drive connected to my ONI headset, ending my recording. When we held an official vote on the matter, H, Shoto, and I voted to patent the ONI headset and release it to the world, with Samantha being the lone voice of dissent. She couldn't forgive me. She told me so right after I cast my vote against her. Right before she dumped me. "We can't be together anymore, Wade," she said, evenly, her voice suddenly devoid of emotion. "Not when we disagree on something so basic and so important. Your actions today will have disastrous consequences. I'm sorry you can't see that." Once my brain finally processed what had happened, I collapsed into a chair, clutching my chest. I was devastated. I was still in love with her. I knew I'd broken her heart, but I also believed releasing the ONI was the right thing to do. If I'd withheld it from billions of suffering people just to preserve our relationship, what would that have made me? When I got her on the phone and tried to tell her this, she got furious once again. She said that I was the one who was being selfish, refusing to see the danger in what we were doing. Then she stopped speaking to me altogether. Luckily, my new ONI headset offered an easy, ready-made escape from my misery. With the press of a button, it literally took my mind off of my broken heart and focused it elsewhere. I could put on the headset and relive another person's happy memories anytime I pleased. Or I could just log into the Oasis, where I was treated like a god and where everything now felt completely real. As real as the most vivid dreams feel while you're having them. When the shard riddle appeared, I'd seized on it as another distraction. But now, over 3 years later, my ongoing obsession with solving it had become a forced and desperate exercise, and I knew it. It was really just an attempt to forget the mess I'd made of my personal life, not that I ever would have admitted it out loud. None of these distractions helped me fix what was broken, of course. I still thought about Samantha every day, and I still wondered what I could have done differently. These days, I told myself that Samantha would have broken up with me eventually anyway. By the end of that first week at Ogg's estate, I'd already begun to wonder if she was having second thoughts. She'd started to pick up on my annoying idiosyncrasies, my inability to recognize social cues, my total and complete lack of cool around strangers, my neediness and emotional immaturity. She was probably already looking for an excuse to dump my socially awkward ass, and when I chose to vote against her on releasing the ONI, it just fast-forwarded the inevitable. Since our breakup, I'd seen Samantha only via her Oasis avatar and only during our co-owner's meetings. Even then, she rarely spoke to me directly or made eye contact. She seemed to be doing her best to pretend I didn't exist. After our split, she became laser-focused on carrying out her master plan, the plan she told me about during our first meeting when we discussed what we'd do if either of us managed to win Halliday's contest. "If I win that dough, I'm going to make sure everyone on this planet has enough to eat," she'd proclaimed. "Once we tackle world hunger, then we can figure out how to fix the environment and solve the energy crisis." True to her word, she created the Artemis Foundation, a global charity organization devoted to ending world hunger, saving the environment, and solving the energy crisis, and donated nearly all of her massive income to it. She still kept an apartment on the top floor of the Artemis Foundation building in downtown Columbus, a few blocks from GSS, but she spent very little time there. She traveled constantly, visiting the world's most troubled and impoverished nations to focus media attention on their plight and to oversee the Artemis Foundation's aid efforts. She also used her newfound fame and wealth to champion a whole host of environmental and humanitarian causes around the world. And seemingly overnight, she transformed herself into a sort of rock star philanthropist and humanitarian. She was like Oprah, Joan Jett, and Mother Teresa all rolled into one. She now had billions of admirers, and in spite of everything, I couldn't help but be one of them. But she wasn't the only one trying to make the world a better place. H, Shoto, and I were each doing our part, too. Shoto created his own charity organization called the Daisho Council, which provided free food, housing, healthcare, and counseling to the millions of isolated Japanese kids known as hikikomori, who lived in self-imposed seclusion from the outside world. H set up a similar charity in North America called Helen's House, which provided a safe haven for homeless LGBTQIA kids throughout the United States and Canada, along with another foundation devoted to providing impoverished African nations with self-sustaining technology and resources. And for kicks, she called it the Wakandan Outreach Initiative. I'd started the Parzival Relief Organization, a nonprofit that provided free food, electricity, internet access, and ONI headsets to orphaned and impoverished kids around the world. It was honestly the sort of help I would have wanted to receive if I had still been a kid living in the stacks. We'd also started funneling cash to the struggling U.S. government and its citizens who had been surviving on foreign aid for decades. We paid off the national debt and provided aerial defense drones and tactical telebots to help reestablish the rule of law in the rural areas where local infrastructure had collapsed along with the power grid. Human law enforcement officers no longer had to risk their own lives to uphold the law. Our police telebots were able to carry out their mission to serve and protect without putting any human lives at risk. Their programming and their operational fail-safes prevented them from harming anyone in the line of duty. Together, Samantha, H, Shoto, and I donated billions of dollars every year. But plenty of rich people, like Ogden Morrow, have been throwing mountains of money at these same problems for decades with little effect. And so far, the High Five's own noble efforts weren't moving the dial much either. For the time being, we were holding chaos and collapse at bay, but humanity's perilous predicament just kept on getting worse. The reason for this was painfully obvious to me. We'd already passed the point of no return. The world's population was fast approaching 10 billion people, and Mother Earth was making it abundantly clear that she could no longer sustain all of us. Especially not after we'd spent the past two centuries poisoning her oceans and atmosphere with wild industrial abandon. We had made our bed, and now we were going to die in it. That was why I was still working on my backup plan, the one I'd shared with Samantha that first night we met. Over the past 3 years, I had funded the construction of a small nuclear-powered interstellar spacecraft in low Earth orbit. It housed a self-sustaining biosphere which could provide long-term living space and life support for a crew of up to 24 human passengers, including H and Shoto, who had joined me in footing the enormous construction bill. I'd christened my ship the Vonnegut, like my old Firefly-class spaceship in the Oasis, which I'd named after my favorite author. If the Vonnegut's fusion engines functioned as they were supposed to, and the radiation shielding held up, and the ship's armored hull didn't get punctured by any micrometeors or crushed by an asteroid, we would reach Proxima Centauri in approximately 47 years. There, we would search for a habitable Earth-like planet where we could make a new home for ourselves, our children, and the frozen human embryos we were going to bring along. We'd been accepting embryo donations for over a year by this point, from every country around the world, with the hope of ensuring genetic diversity. The ship's onboard computer contained a new standalone virtual reality simulation for us to access on our long journey. After much debate over what we should call our new virtual realm, we finally agreed upon the name Arcadia. It was H's idea to replace the A in the middle with an at sign to give the name a leet flourish and to help distinguish it from the geographic region in central Greece, the Duran Duran side project, the city on Gallifrey, the alternate plane of reality in Dungeons & Dragons, and all of the other Arcadias out there. The addition of the at was also fitting because, as H put it, Arcadia will be where it's at. Arcadia was going to serve as our own private scaled-down version of the Oasis during the voyage. It was still a work in progress, and likely would be until the day we departed. Due to various space and hardware limitations, our simulation wasn't nearly as big, about half the size of one Oasis sector. But that was still a vast amount of virtual space for us and our tiny crew to inhabit. We had enough room to upload copies of more than 200 of our favorite Oasis planets, along with their NPCs. We didn't bother transferring any of the business content or retail planets over. Where we were going, we wouldn't need stores or commerce. Besides, we had to be sparing with our data storage space, since we were bringing along a backup copy of the entire Oninet file database, too. It was updated every night, along with new Oasis content. There was one other thing that made our simulation different from its predecessor. Unlike the Oasis, Arcadia could only be accessed via a neural interface headset. We didn't want to waste any time, space, or money bringing outdated haptic technology along. The Vonnegut was still about a year from being complete, but H, Shoto, and I were in no rush. We weren't eager to leave the Earth behind for a long, cramped and perilous voyage, and we weren't ready to give up on planet Earth yet either, not while there was still a chance we could save it. What we were doing was doomsday prepping on a multi-billionaire scale, packing the ultimate bug-out bag, the means to escape the planet if and when everything went to shit. We'd concealed the details of the Vonnegut project from the world and from Samantha for as long as we could. But eventually, word of what we were up to leaked to the press. Of course, Samantha was furious when she found out we'd spent over $300 billion to build a ship to escape our dying planet instead of using that money and manpower to help her try to save it. I told her we were saving a spot for her on the Vonnegut's crew, but you can imagine how that went over. She stormed out, then she crucified us in the press. She accused us of sabotaging humanity by releasing the ONI to the masses and then using the profits to build a lifeboat to save our own skin. But I didn't see it that way. And thankfully, neither did H or Shoto. We admired Samantha's optimism, and maybe, on a good day, even shared in it. But with Earth teetering on the brink of destruction, leaving our eggs in one basket was foolish. Sending a small contingent of humanity out into space was the only responsible thing to do. And at this precarious moment in history, we were the only three people on the planet with the resources to do it. 0002. After 24 laps in my heated indoor Olympic-sized swimming pool, which, thanks to my AR swim goggles, was teeming with rare tropical fish and even a pod of friendly dolphins to keep me company, I was standing in my walk-in closet, surrounded by tailored suits and designer clothes I had never worn and probably never would. I wore the same outfit every day, so I never had to expend any thought on what to wear next. I got the idea from Jeff Goldblum in The Fly, and he in turn got it from Albert Einstein. I was equally disciplined about my daily workout, even when I was feeling under the weather. Exercising for at least 2 hours every day was an absolute necessity since I frequently spent over 11 hours a day logged into the Oasis with my ONI headset, followed by another 8 hours of sleep on top of that. For me, it seemed to take at least 2 hours of vigorous exercise to balance out the 20 or so hours of each day that I spent not moving at all. Like eating and sleeping, exercise was one of the things people still had to do in reality. None of the simulated physical activity you experienced through your ONI headset actually had any real-world effects, like improving your circulation or increasing your muscle tone. I finished lacing up my vintage Air Jordans and stepped outside onto the balcony where my usual breakfast was waiting for me. As I took a seat at the table, one of my humanoid service robots, Belvedere, uncovered my omelet and hash browns and poured me a glass of freshly squeezed orange juice. Then he retreated to the corner of the balcony and stood there like a statue, waiting to be of further use. I'd programmed Belvedere never to speak unless spoken to, because his synthesized voice set me on edge, regardless of how much I tweaked his tone or inflection, probably because I'd seen too many Robot Uprising movies. There wasn't any actual chance of my service robot staging a revolt, of course. Like most of the artificial intelligence people interacted with on a daily basis, Belvedere and his fellow household bots were Tier 1 AI, which was classified as extremely weak. Tier 1 AI was used to operate service robots, drive automated cars, and fly automated planes. All of our Oasis NPCs were Tier 1s. Tier 2 AI was used mostly for science and military applications, and their use and operating parameters were heavily restricted by most world governments. Tier 2s could form short-term memories and had stronger independent learning abilities, but they still did not have the capacity for autonomy or any sort of identity or self-awareness. Tier 3 AI was the real deal: fully autonomous, self-aware, and conscious. The kind that science fiction films warn you about. This level of artificial intelligence was still theoretical, praise be to Crom, but according to GSS's top engineers, probably not for much longer. The race to create true artificial intelligence had become like the race to create the atomic bomb. Several different countries, including my own, were working to create full-blown, self-aware, as smart, if not smarter than the average human being, artificial intelligence. Maybe some of them already had, and now it was just a waiting game to see who would unleash it first, probably in an army of sentient aerial drones and battle telebots that said Roger, Roger to one another while machine-gunning civilian populations. That was if we didn't nuke ourselves into oblivion first. I ate in silence for a few minutes, staring up at the sky overhead. When I finished my food, I put my AR specs on again and used them to log into my Oasis account. Then I used a heavily encrypted remote access code to take control of a telebot, a humanoid telepresence robot that was located in high orbit above the Earth aboard the Vonnegut. Once my link to the bot was established, my AR specs allowed me to see through its eyes, a set of stereoscopic video cameras mounted in its head. I disconnected the telebot from its charging dock, which was anchored to a bulkhead in the ship's forward cargo hold. This was in the ring-shaped section of the craft, which rotated constantly to generate centripetal force and create simulated gravity. I piloted the telebot over to a circular observation window set into the outer hull. Then I waited a few seconds for the ring to rotate around until the luminous blue curve of the Earth came into view, filling my field of vision. The Vonnegut was currently passing over North America, and through a break in the cloud cover, I was able to locate the outline of Lake Erie, and then the dense urban grid of Columbus just below it. I stabilized and magnified the image until I had a satellite's view of my own house and the patio where I was currently sitting. For a second or two, I was able to gaze down at myself through the eyes of a telepresence robot aboard a starship orbiting the Earth. When the Earth rotated out of view again, I turned the telebot away from the window. Then I used it to make a quick circuit of the ship. Dozens of other telebots floated through each of its sections under the control of the technicians and engineers back on Earth. They were running diagnostic tests on the experimental heavy-duty radiation shielding around the frozen embryo storage compartment. After watching them work for a while, I piloted my telebot into the ship's network operations center to check on the Arcadia backup servers and the Oasis uplink from Earth that we used to keep our copy of various planets in the simulation up to date. Everything appeared to be running smoothly. We still had plenty of extra storage space for future Arcadia content updates on the Vonnegut's computer. Its processing power limited us to a maximum of 100 simultaneous Arcadia users, but that was far more than we needed. I spent a few more minutes piloting my telebot through the silent corridors of the ship before I returned it to its charging dock. Then I disconnected from it, and just like that, I was back on Earth, sitting on my patio. I'd traveled all the way to space and back, and I'd only managed to kill 15 minutes. I tried calling H and Shoto to see if either of them wanted to catch up before our co-owners meeting, but as usual, neither of them picked up. I took off my specs and threw them on the table in front of me with a sigh. I told myself that H was probably still asleep and that Shoto was probably busy with work. I could have checked their account statuses to see, but I'd learned the hard way that if your friends were avoiding you, you didn't want or need to know about it. I continued to eat my breakfast in silence, listening to the wind in the trees and absentmindedly watching the flock of security drones overhead as they patrolled the perimeter of my estate. This was usually the only time I spent outdoors each day to get my daily minimum dose of sunlight. Deep down, I still shared Halliday's opinion that going outside was highly overrated. I pulled my AR specs back on and skimmed over the emails that had collected in my inbox overnight. Then I spent some time updating my Oninet queue with new recs and sims from the most popular downloads list. I did this every morning, even though I already had thousands of hours of experiences in my queue, more than I would ever have time to make it through, even if I lived to be 100. That was why I constantly updated and rearranged the clips in my queue, to make sure I got to the best stuff first. In the early days of the Oninet, some people at GSS had worried that its popularity might cause the rest of the Oasis to become a ghost town, because everyone would spend all of their time doing playback instead of exploring the Oasis to have experiences of their own. But the Oasis continued to grow and thrive alongside the Oninet, and most users divided their time equally between the two. Perhaps it was human nature to crave both passive and interactive forms of entertainment. As usual, I searched the Oninet for any newly listed clips tagged with the name Artemis or Samantha Cook. Whenever anyone posted a recording in which she appeared, I would download it. Even if it was just a clip of her signing an autograph for someone, it still gave me a chance to experience standing next to her for a few seconds. I knew how pathetic this was, which somehow made it even more pathetic. But trust me, there were far more twisted and depraved clips I could have been playing back. The current top download in the NSFW section of the Oninet library was a 50-person orgy recorded simultaneously by all 50 participants, giving the viewer the ability to jump from one participant's body to the next at will, like some hedonistic demon. Cyberstalking my ex-girlfriend at her public appearances seemed like a pretty tame pastime in comparison. Don't get me wrong. The Oninet wasn't just a way for people to experience guilt-free sex and risk-free drug use. It was also an incredibly powerful tool for fostering empathy and understanding. Entertainers and politicians and artists and activists used this new communication medium to connect with a global audience with profound results. The Artemis Foundation had even started posting .oni clips now, first-person slice-of-life recordings made by impoverished and exploited people around the globe designed to expose others to their plight. It was a brilliant and effective use of ONI technology, but it also seemed hypocritical of Samantha to use the ONI to further her own agenda after railing against its release. When I'd said so during one of our meetings, Samantha made it abundantly clear that she didn't give a flying frack at a rolling Wrathtar what I thought. I ate the last bite of my now cold omelet and dropped my napkin on my plate. Belvedere sprang into action and began to clear off the table, the servos in his robotic limbs whirring with each of his small, precise movements. What now? I could head over to my music room to knock out my daily guitar lesson. One of my new hobbies was learning to play guitar in reality, which proved to be very different and far more difficult than playing a simulated axe in the Oasis. Luckily, I had the best guitar teacher imaginable, a fully licensed hologram of the great Edward Van Halen, circa the release of 1984. He was a taskmaster, too. Thanks to his tutelage, I was starting to get pretty good. Or I could take another Bollywood dance lesson. I was practicing for H and Indira's wedding in a few months. I knew that Samantha would be in attendance, and I'd secretly begun to harbor an idiotic fantasy that I might be able to win her back when she saw me tearing up the dance floor. A message popped up on my AR display reminding me that I had an appointment scheduled with my therapist this morning. I always scheduled a therapy session before our GSS co-owners meeting to help put me in a calm, non-confrontational frame of mind and, hopefully, prevent me from starting any unnecessary arguments with Samantha. Sometimes it even worked. I selected the icon for the therapy program on the HUD of my AR specs, and my virtual therapist appeared in the empty chair across the table from me. When you first installed the software, you were allowed to select your therapist's physical appearance and personality from thousands of pre-made options, from Freud to Frasier. I'd selected Sean McGuire, Robin Williams' character in Good Will Hunting. His familiar demeanor, his warm smile, and his fake Boston accent made our sessions feel like I was talking to an old friend, even though he usually only said things like, "Yes, go on," and "How does that make you feel, Wade?" I also had the ability to change the location where I met with him. The default setting was his office at the community college where he taught, the same location where most of his sessions with Will Hunting took place in the film. Or you could choose one of several bars in Southie, including Timmy's Tap or the L Street Tavern. But I felt like changing things up this morning, so I selected the bench by the lake at Boston Public Garden. And an instant later, Sean and I were sitting on it, side by side, staring at the swans. He began by asking me if I was still having nightmares about my Aunt Alice's death. I lied and told him no, because I didn't feel like discussing the subject again. He moved on to my social media addiction, his term, and asked me how I felt my recovery was progressing. Just over a month ago, I'd placed an irreversible lock on all my social media accounts. I couldn't use any of them for a full year. I told Sean that I was still experiencing withdrawal symptoms, but they were beginning to subside. Meat feed addiction had been around since before I was born, but it had become even more common in the wake of the ONI's release. Most of the early social media platforms like Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter had migrated into the Oasis shortly after it launched, and they all still existed there today in your Meat feed, the consolidated social media feed timeline built into every user's account. It allowed the billions of Oasis users around the world to share messages, memes, files, photos, songs, videos, celebrity gossip, pornography, and petty insults with one another, just as people have been doing on the internet for the past half century. I'd never been good in social situations of any kind, so I'd avoided social media entirely for most of my life, and I should have kept on avoiding it once I became a public figure. It turned out I just wasn't comfortable living in the spotlight. I was an awkward kid who was good at video games and memorizing trivia. I was not mentally or emotionally equipped to have the whole world's attention focused on me. At any given moment, there were millions of people posting shit at or about me somewhere online. This had been the case ever since I first found the Copper Key, but it was only after I'd won the contest that the haters came out in force. It made sense in hindsight. The moment I inherited Halliday's fortune, I was no longer the scrappy underdog from the stacks doing heroic battle with the Sixers. I was just another asshole billionaire living a life of ease in his ivory tower. None of the stuff my friends and I did to try to help humanity seemed to make any difference. My detractors in the media began to refer to my avatar as Parvenu instead of Parzival, while the less pretentious garden variety assholes online instead chose to adopt IROC's old nickname for me, Penisville. Things got really bad when a previously unknown music group called Tapioca Shindig released a song titled Sixer Filleting Punk, which used an auto-tuned soundbite from the live POV broadcast I'd made during the Battle of Castle Anorak, when I'd publicly declared to the world that, quote, "If I find Halliday's Easter egg, I hereby vow to split my winnings equally with Artemis, H, and Shoto. If I'm lying, I should be forever branded as a gutless sixer-filleting punk." But they only took the last part, so the lyrics to the whole song were just me singing, "I should be forever branded as a gutless sixer-filleting punk," over and over. The song instantly went viral. It was Tapioca Shindig's one and only hit single. They posted a music video to the OniNet that racked up over 1 billion downloads before I had it taken offline. Then I sued the band for defamation and bankrupted each of its members, which of course only made the public hate me even more. Samantha H. and Shoto received their fair share of online hate too, of course, but they took it in stride. They were somehow able to bask in the adoration of their billions of fans while ignoring the ire of even their most vocal detractors. I appeared to lack the emotional maturity necessary to pull off that little trick. Yes, I knew the haters' opinions were utterly meaningless and had no effect whatsoever on our real lives. Unless, of course, we let it. Which, of course, I did. And yes, the rational part of my brain knew that the vast majority of the people who trolled us online were acting out due to crushing disappointment with their own miserable lives. And who could blame them? Reality was completely miserable for the vast majority of the world's population. I should have taken pity on the sad, pathetic souls who had nothing better to do with their time than vent their frustrations by attacking me and my friends. Instead, I went on a rage-induced troll-killing spree. Several of them, actually. The super-user abilities I'd inherited from Halliday allowed me to circumvent the Oasis's strict policy of user anonymity. So when some snide douchebag using the handle Penisville Hater posted something nasty about me on the Mead feeds, I pulled up his private account profile, pinpointed his avatar's location inside the Oasis, and waited till he set foot inside a PvP zone. Then, before Penisville Hater even knew what was happening, I made my avatar invisible, teleported in, and zeroed his ass out with a 99th level Finger of Death spell. Now that my avatar wore the robes of Anorak, I was both omnipotent and invulnerable, so there was literally nothing anyone could do to stop me. I gleefully zeroed out hundreds of trolls in this fashion. If someone talked shit about me, I found them and killed their avatar. If someone posted something hateful about Artemis or her foundation, I found them and killed their avatar. If someone posted a racist meme about H or a video attacking Shoto's work, I found them and killed their avatar. Usually right after I asked them the rhetorical question, "Who run Bartertown?" Eventually, people began to accuse me of being the untraceable, undetectable, ultra-powerful avatar behind the killings, and the resulting online media backlash, dubbed Parzivalgate, destroyed my public image. Thanks to my robes, there was no hard evidence against me, and of course I denied everything, but even I had to admit that the circumstantial case was pretty strong. Gee, a bunch of avatars get killed by an undetectable, all-powerful avatar, and the only thing they have in common is that they trash-talked the one person most likely to have an undetectable, all-powerful avatar? A petition calling for official sanctions against me was digitally signed by hundreds of millions of daily Oasis users. A few dozen class action lawsuits were filed against me. In the end, none of them amounted to anything. I was a multi-billionaire with unlimited resources and the world's best lawyers on my payroll, and there was no proof of wrongdoing on my part. But there was nothing I could do about the anger I'd caused. Finally, H took me aside for a long talk. She reminded me how fortunate and powerful I was now, even if, on the inside, I still felt like that underdog kid from the stacks. She told me to grow up and let it go. Cultivate an attitude of gratitude, Z. I reluctantly took her advice and went into therapy. I could have afforded a real-life human therapist, of course. But I found it easier to share my innermost thoughts with a computer program than with another person. A virtual therapist couldn't judge you or share your secrets with its spouse for laughs. It would never repeat anything I said to anyone, and that was the only sort of therapist I could bring myself to confide in. After a few sessions with Sean, I'd realized that the best thing for my mental health would be to abandon social media altogether. So I had, and it was the right choice. My anger abated, and my wounded pride began to heal. I'd finally gained enough distance from my addiction to realize something. Human beings were never meant to participate in a worldwide social network comprised of billions of people. We were designed by evolution to be hunter-gatherers with the mental capacity to interact and socialize with the other members of our tribe, a tribe made up of a few hundred other people at most. Interacting with thousands or even millions of other people on a daily basis was way too much for our ape-descended melons to handle. That was why social media had been gradually driving the entire population of the world insane since it emerged back around the turn of the century. I was even beginning to wonder if the invention of a worldwide social network was actually the great filter that theoretically caused all technological civilizations to go extinct instead of nuclear weapons or climate change. Maybe every time an intelligent species grew advanced enough to invent a global computer network, they would then develop some form of social media, which would immediately fill these beings with such an intense hatred for one another that they ended up wiping themselves out within 4 or 5 decades. Only time would tell. One thing I had never shared with my therapist, or with anyone, was the comfort I took from knowing that I had access to the big red button. Not that I would ever actually press it. I'd read all of the worst-case scenarios and seen the disaster simulations created by GSS's in-house think tanks, predicting what would happen if the Oasis went offline. The outlook was never pretty. The general consensus was this: if the Oasis stopped working for more than a few days, so would human civilization. This had become even more of a certainty in the wake of our merger with IOI, because nearly all of the support operations that kept the global internet backbone running were now dependent on the Oasis in some form, as were the vast majority of the security and defense systems around the world, at the national, state, local, and home level. If the Oasis went down, the internet would probably suffer a catastrophic collapse of its infrastructure a short time later, and our already precarious human civilization would begin to rapidly collapse too. That was why GSS had so many backup server installations all over the world. Nobody knew that the Oasis's creator had rigged the whole simulation with a self-destruct button, and that I alone now had access to it. Nobody knew that the fate of the whole world was literally in my hands, except me. And I wanted to keep it that way. Once my virtual therapy session was over, I headed downstairs and made the long trek to my office at the far end of the mansion's east wing. This was the same enormous oak-paneled room that had served as Halliday's office when he lived here. It was also the room in which Halliday had designed and programmed his elaborate Easter egg hunt. He'd even included a recreation of this office in the hunt's final challenge. To me, this room was hallowed ground, and I'd spent 3 years and millions of dollars recreating the vast collection of classic video game consoles and home computers Halliday had originally kept on display here. The office contained over 100 glass tables, arranged in a large egg-shaped pattern on the floor. On each table was a different vintage home computer or video game system, along with tiered racks that held a collection of its peripherals, controllers, software, and games. Each collection was meticulously arranged and displayed like a museum exhibit. A conventional Oasis immersion rig sat in one corner of the room collecting dust. I only used it for emergencies now when I needed to access the Oasis after I'd hit my 12-hour ONI daily usage limit. It was hard to believe that just a few years ago, I'd been completely content accessing the Oasis with my visor and haptic rig. Once you got used to an ONI headset, the old hardware made everything look and feel painfully fake, even with the best haptics money could buy. My new prototype Motive, a mobile tactical immersion vault, sat on a circular elevator pad in the center of the room. The motive was a logical extension of the concept of the standard immersion vault, an armored coffin that protected your sleeping body while your mind roamed the oasis. Except that my new device didn't just provide passive protection. Part of GSS's new Super Vault Deluxe line of tactical Oasis immersion vaults, the motive looked more like a heavily armed robotic spider than a coffin. It was an armored escape vehicle and all-terrain weapons platform, featuring 8 retractable armored legs for navigating all forms of terrain, and a pair of machine guns and grenade launchers mounted on each side of its armored chassis, not to mention a bulletproof acrylic cockpit canopy for its occupant. Our in-house ad agency had already come up with the perfect slogan. If you're going to use lethal force to defend yourself, you better have a motive. If I was awake, I could operate my motive using the control panel located inside the cockpit. If I was logged into the Oasis with an ONI headset, I could control the motive from inside the simulation via my avatar. So if my body came under attack while I was logged in, I wouldn't need to log out before I could defend myself. And I could hurl insults at my would-be assailants through the ear-splittingly loud speakers mounted on its heavily armored exoskeleton. The motive was overkill, considering the small army of security guards and defense drones guarding my house. But state-of-the-art toys like these were a perk of my position at GSS. And I had to admit, having it made me feel a lot less anxious about leaving my body unattended for 12 hours every day. Most ONI users couldn't afford a standard immersion vault, let alone a personal armored attack vehicle. Some settled for locking themselves in a room or closet before they entered the sleep-like state induced by the ONI headset. Others asked someone they trusted to watch over their helpless body while their mind was temporarily disconnected from it. Of course, as Artemis was fond of pointing out, plenty of users didn't take any precautions at all when they put on their ONI headsets, and plenty of them paid the price for doing so. A new breed of thieves, rapists, serial killers, and organ harvesters preyed on those ONI users who failed to lock up their bodies while their minds were on vacation. But over the past few years, thousands of body locker capsule hotels had opened up around the world, where people could rent coffin-sized rooms for just a few credits a day. It was the lowest rent housing imaginable. They couldn't build them fast enough to meet the demand. To increase user safety, GSS had also started selling deluxe ONI headsets featuring built-in motion-activated cameras with video feeds that could be monitored from inside the Oasis. Immersion vaults were also equipped with interior and exterior cameras that allowed their occupants to monitor their physical body and its surroundings from inside the Oasis, along with motion detectors that would alert them if anyone came within spitting distance of their body in the URL. I went into the office's private bathroom and remained there until I'd emptied my bowels and bladder as much as possible. This had become a pre-login ritual for every ONI user, especially those who wanted to remain logged in for a full 12 hours without soiling themselves. When I emerged from the bathroom, I climbed into the motive and settled into the form-fitting gel foam flotation recliner. Its padded retaining bands locked into place around my arms, legs, and waist to keep me from falling out. Throughout my long ONI session, the recliner would periodically rotate my body and flex my limbs to increase circulation and prevent muscle atrophy. There were also special suits you could wear that would electrically stimulate your muscles while you were under, but they irritated my skin, so I never wore them. I pressed a button to close the motive's canopy. Then I pressed another button to activate the circular elevator pad it was sitting on. I grinned and braced myself for a drop just before the pad began to rocket down the elevator shaft. Lights embedded in the shaft's reinforced titanium wall flew by in a blur. This elevator had been designed so that if you looked straight up during its descent, it perfectly recreated the look of the top-secret Pepsi elevator guarded by B.B. King in Spies Like Us. It, and the bunker it led to, had both been constructed by Halliday when he'd first moved into this house, so that he would have a place to ride out World War III, which was still threatening to break out at any moment, just as it had been for the past 100 years. Now I used his bunker for my daily 12-hour ONI dives, content in the knowledge that I was deep enough and well-protected enough to survive a missile strike on my house, on the off chance that some nutjob despot with a death wish managed to get one past our global defense network and the redundant one GSS maintained over the entire city of Columbus to prevent terrorist attacks on our Oasis servers, and the even more redundant anti-ballistic missile installations that surrounded my home. The whole world knew my address, so I didn't feel like I was being paranoid. I was just taking sensible precautions. When the elevator's blast doors slid open, I used the Motiv's cockpit controls to spider-walk it forward into the bunker's receiving bay, which was just a big, empty concrete room with lights embedded in its ceiling. The elevator stood at one end, and a pair of large armored doors stood at the other, leading to the high-tech, fully stocked bomb shelter beyond. I secretly loved coming down here. 3 kilometers beneath the earth in this armored concrete bunker, I felt like I was in my own private bat cave. Although it was obvious to me now that Bruce Wayne never would have been able to construct his crime-fighting crib all by himself in total secrecy with no one to help him lay the plumbing and pour the concrete but his geriatric butler. No way. I lowered my Motiv to the concrete floor, retracted its legs, and placed it into standard defense mode. Then I removed my ONI headset from its cradle above my head and put it on. When I powered it on, its titanium sensor bands automatically retracted to fit the contours of my skull before locking themselves tightly in place so that the headset couldn't be moved or jostled by even a micrometer. If that were to happen in the middle of my ONI session, it would be bad. I pressed a button to close the Motiv's armored canopy and slid it shut with a pneumatic hiss, sealing me safely inside its roomy cockpit. Then I cleared my throat and said, "Initiate login sequence." I felt a familiar tingling sensation all over my scalp as the headset scanned my brain and verified my identity. Then a female voice prompted me to speak my passphrase, and I recited it, being careful to enunciate each syllable. I'd recently reset it to the same passphrase I'd used during the latter days of Halliday's Hunt, a lyric from the 1987 song, "Don't Let's Start," by They Might Be Giants. No one in the world ever gets what they want, and that is beautiful. Once my passphrase was accepted, and I agreed to the ONI safety warning, the system finished logging me in. I heard myself breathe a sigh of relief as reality receded, and the Oasis faded into existence all around me. 0003. I materialized inside my stronghold on Falco, the small asteroid in Sector 14 that still served as my avatar's home inside the Oasis. I'd tried relocating to Castle Anorak after I inherited it, but I didn't really like the decor or the general vibe over there. I felt more at home here, in my old digs, which I'd designed and built myself. I was seated in my command center. This was the same spot where my avatar had been sitting the previous night when I'd reached my 12-hour ONI usage limit and the system had automatically logged me out. The control panels arrayed in front of me were crammed with switches, buttons, keyboards, joysticks, and display screens. The bank of security monitors on my left were linked to virtual cameras placed throughout the interior and exterior of my stronghold. To my right, another bank of monitors displayed vid feeds from the real-world cameras mounted on the interior and exterior of my immersion vault. My sleeping body was visible from several different angles, along with a detailed readout of its vital signs. I gazed out the transparent dome at the barren, cratered landscape surrounding my stronghold. This had been my avatar's home during the final year of Halliday's contest, and I'd cracked one of its major riddles while sitting in this very chair. I hoped the familiar setting would help me make a breakthrough in my quest for the 7 shards. So far, it hadn't worked. I accessed the teleportation menu on my avatar's super user HUD, then scrolled down the list of bookmarked locations until I found the listing for the planet Gregarious in Sector 1, the home of Gregarious Simulation Systems' virtual offices inside the Oasis. When I selected it and tapped the teleport icon, my avatar was instantly transported to a set of previously saved coordinates, hundreds of millions of virtual kilometers away. If I'd been a normal Oasis user, this trip would have cost me some serious coin. But since I wore the robes of Anorak, I could teleport anywhere, at any time, for free. It was a far cry from the days when I was a broke school kid stranded on Ludus. My avatar reappeared on the top floor of Gregarious Tower, a virtual replica of the real GSS skyscraper in downtown Columbus. Our head of operations, Faisal Sodi, was standing in the reception area waiting for me. "Mr. Watts," Faisal said. "Good to see you, sir." "It's good to see you too, man," I replied. I'd given up on trying to convince Faisal to address me as Wade or Z years ago. He walked over to greet me, and I shook his outstretched hand. Being able to shake hands without any danger of spreading disease had always been one of the perks of the Oasis, but in the old days, before the ONI was released, it always felt like you were shaking hands with a mannequin, even with the best haptic gloves available. Without the sensation of skin-to-skin human contact, the ancient greeting lost most of its meaning. After we'd introduced the ONI, shaking hands had come back in vogue, along with high fives and fist bumps, because now they felt real. The conference room itself was protected by both magical and technological means. We held our co-owners' meetings here instead of in a standard Oasis chat room because it allowed all sorts of additional security measures to be taken to prevent anyone from recording or eavesdropping on us, including our own employees. "Are the others already here?" I asked, nodding toward the closed doors behind him. "Ms. H and Mr. Shoto both arrived a few minutes ago," he said, opening the doors, "but Ms. Cook called to say she's running a bit late." I nodded and went into the conference room. H and Shoto were standing over by the wraparound floor-to-ceiling windows, grazing from a ridiculously large assortment of snack trays that were laid out nearby while they admired the impressive view. Gregarious Tower was surrounded by acres of pristine forest land, with snow-capped mountain peaks ringing the horizon. There were no other structures in sight. By design, everything about the view was calming and peaceful. Unfortunately, the same could never be said of the meetings we held here. "Z!" H and Shoto announced in unison when they spotted me. I walked over and received high fives from each of them. "How goes it, mis amigos?" "It's way too early for this shit, man," H groaned. She was in L.A. where it was currently 10 o'clock in the morning. H liked to stay up late and sleep in even later. "Yeah," Shoto added after a quarter-second delay from his translator software. "And it's way too late for this shit." He was in Japan where it was the middle of the night, but Shoto was nocturnal by nature. He was just complaining because he'd grown to dread these meetings, just like me and H. "Artie's running late," H said. "She's supposed to be logging in from Liberia, I think." "Yeah," I said, rolling my eyes. "That's the most recent stop on our ongoing tour of the world's most depressing places." I still couldn't fathom why Samantha felt the need to endure all of the hassles and risks of real-world travel when she could have visited safely via telepresence robot or experienced any location in the world by downloading a .oni clip recorded there. She also could have visited any of those countries inside the Oasis. There was an incredibly detailed recreation of Earth in Sector 10 called E-Earth, short for Ersatz Earth. That was constantly being updated with data taken from live satellite imagery, drone footage, and traffic security and smartphone camera feeds to make it as accurate as possible. Visiting Dubai, Bangkok, or Delhi on E-Earth was a lot easier and safer than visiting them in reality. But Samantha felt it was imperative for her to witness the true state of the world with her own two eyes, even when it came to the most dangerous, war-torn countries. In other words, she was crazy. "No, she's selfless and principled," replied a nagging little voice in my head. "And you're neither of those things. Is it any wonder she dumped you?" I clenched my teeth. These co-owners' meetings were always bad for my self-esteem, and not just because it forced me to see Artemis. H and Shoto were also living glamorous and fulfilling post-contest lives. The reclusive, obsessive existence I'd carved out for myself seemed painfully bleak by comparison. These days, if I wanted to hang out with H or Shoto, I had to make an appointment several weeks in advance. But I didn't mind. I was grateful they still made time to hang out with me at all. Unlike me, they had more than two friends. And they also spent a lot more of their time offline than I did. Instead of downloading pieces of other people's lives off the OniNet, H and Shoto were out in the world having and recording experiences of their own. In fact, they were two of the most popular celebrity posters on the OniNet. Every clip either of them threw up went viral within a few seconds, regardless of its content. Like Artemis, they were brilliant, charismatic people, leading rock star lives while also working to improve the lives of the less fortunate. More than once, it had occurred to me that my friends were my one saving grace. The thing I took the most pride in, even more than winning Halliday's fortune, was the three people I'd chosen to share that fortune with. H, Shoto, and Artemis were all kinder, wiser, and saner than I was or ever would be. After the contest ended, Helen legally changed her name to H, with no surname, just like Sting and Madonna. And since her true identity, appearance, and gender were now public knowledge in the wake of Halliday's contest, she'd promptly ditched the world-famous white male avatar she'd used to mask her true identity since childhood. Like Samantha and Shoto and many other real-world celebrities, H now used an Oasis Ravatar, an avatar that recreated her unaltered real-world appearance and was updated each and every time she logged into the simulation. I had never been a huge fan of my real-world appearance, so I used the same Oasis avatar I always had, an idealized version of myself, a bit taller, fitter, and more handsome. These days, H spent most of her real-world time chilling in her Santa Monica beach house or touring with her new fiancé, Indira Vinayak, a famous singer and Bollywood star. Becoming a billionaire hadn't altered H's personality at all, so far as I could tell. She still liked to have ridiculous arguments about old movies. She still loved to get her kills on in PvP arena tournaments. And she remained one of the league's highest-ranked combatants in both the Deathmatch and Capture the Flag leagues. In other words, H was still a total badass. Except now, she was a total badass who also happened to be insanely rich and world famous. I still considered H my best friend, but we weren't nearly as close now as we'd been in the old days. I hadn't seen her in person in over 2 years, although we still got together online once or twice a month. But these meetups were always my suggestion, and I was beginning to worry that H only spent time with me out of some lingering sense of obligation, or because she was worried about me. Either way, I didn't care. I was just grateful that she still made time for me and that she still wanted me in her life. I saw Shoto even less frequently than H, which was understandable. His life had changed drastically in the years since the contest. Shoto's parents had helped him manage his inheritance when he was still a minor, but he'd turned 18 a year ago, making him a legal adult in Japan. Now, he had full control of his own life and his share of Halliday's fortune. To celebrate, he legally adopted his avatar's name, just like H. Then he got married to a young woman named Kiki, whom he met when he relocated to Hokkaido. He and his new bride moved into a remodeled Japanese castle right on the shore. Then, about 5 months ago, during one of our GSS meetings, Shoto announced that he was going to become a father. He and Kiki had just learned that they were going to have a boy, and together they had already decided to name him Toshiro. But, in confidence, Shoto told us he'd already decided to nickname the baby Little Daito, so that was what I called him too. It was still hard to believe that Shoto would be a father in a few months, at such a young age. I was concerned for him, though I had no idea why. It wasn't like he wouldn't be able to afford to send little Daito to a good school. I just didn't understand why he was in such a big hurry, until he sat me down and explained it to me. Japan was in the midst of an underpopulation crisis, because so many of its citizens had opted to stop having children over the past 3 decades. As the country's wealthiest and most famous young couple, he and Kiki felt obligated to lead by example and reproduce as quickly as possible. So they had. And after little Daito arrived, they planned to start working on a little Shoto, or perhaps a little Kiki. In addition to his preparations for fatherhood, Shoto continued to oversee operations at GSS's Hokkaido division, where he produced a wildly popular series of award-winning Oasis quests based on his favorite anime and samurai films. He'd become one of my favorite quest developers, and I was lucky enough to be one of his go-to beta testers, so we still got to hang out in the Oasis at least once or twice a month. We rarely talked about Shoto's late brother Daito or his murder. But the last time we had, Shoto told me he was still in mourning for him and that he feared he always would be. I understood what he meant because I felt the same way about my Aunt Alice and my old downstairs neighbor, Mrs. Gilmore. Both of them had been murdered, too, by the same man, Nolan Sorrento, the former head of operations at Innovative Online Industries. After Halliday's contest, Sorrento had been convicted of 37 separate counts of first-degree homicide. He was now serving time on death row in a maximum security prison in Chillicothe, Ohio, about 50 miles south of Columbus. During his trial, IOI's lawyers had managed to convince the jury that Sorrento had gone rogue and that he'd acted without the IOI board's knowledge or consent when he ordered his underlings to throw Daito off his 43rd floor balcony. They also claimed that Sorrento had acted alone when he detonated a bomb outside my aunt's trailer in the stacks, killing over 36 people and injuring hundreds of others. After Sorrento's conviction and incarceration, IOI managed to settle all of the wrongful death suits filed against them. Then they tried to go back to business as usual. But by then, they'd already lost their position as the world's largest manufacturer of Oasis immersion hardware, thanks to the release of our ONI headsets. And thanks to the rollout of our free global internet initiative, their ISP business had also shriveled. Meanwhile, IOI also had the audacity to file a separate corporate lawsuit against me. They claimed that even though I'd created a false identity and used it to masquerade as an indentured servant to infiltrate their company headquarters, the indenturement contract I'd signed was still legally binding, which meant, they argued, that I was still technically IOI's property when I won Halliday's contest, and so his fortune and his company should now also be classified as IOI's property. Since the U.S. legal system still insisted on giving corporations even more rights than its citizens, this idiotic lawsuit dragged on for months, right up until GSS completed its hostile takeover of IOI. Then, as IOI's new owners, we withdrew the lawsuit. We also fired the old IOI board of directors, their attorneys, and everyone else who had worked with or under Nolan Sorrento. Now the Sixers were a distant memory, and Innovative Online Industries was just another wholly owned subsidiary of Gregarious Simulation Systems. GSS was now far and away the largest corporation in the world, and if we kept growing at our current rate, before too long, we might be the only one. That was the reason a lot of our own users had started to refer to GSS as the new Sixers, and me, H, Shoto, and Samantha as the four nerds of the apocalypse. Two-Face was right. You either die the hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. I made small talk with H and Shoto for a few more minutes until the conference room doors swung open and Samantha's avatar, Artemis, strolled in. She glanced in our direction but didn't offer anything in the way of a greeting. Faisal walked in after her and closed the doors behind him. We all took our usual seats, which put me and Artemis on opposite sides of the circular conference table, as far away from each other as possible, but also directly facing each other. "Thank you all for coming," Faisal said, taking a seat next to Samantha. "I think we're ready to call this co-owners meeting to order. We only have a few items to cover today, the first one being our quarterly revenue report." An array of charts and graphs appeared on the large screen behind him. "As usual, it's all good news. ONI headset sales remain steady, and Immersion Vault sales have nearly doubled since last quarter. Oasis advertising and Surreal Estate revenue also both remain at an all-time high." Faisal continued to detail how great our company was doing, but I didn't hear much of what he was saying. I was too busy stealing glances at Artemis across the table. I knew she wouldn't catch me because she made a point of never looking in my direction. Her avatar looked the same as it always had, with one minor change. After the contest, she'd added the reddish-purple birthmark